to remind you what somebody is who is transgender. It means, and you'll remember when we were talking about this in the worldview section of this class, to identify oneself as transgender is to reject, the language goes, the gender with which you were identified at birth. So anatomically, the doctor said, oh, that's a boy, or that's a girl. A transgender says, no, anatomically, I may have the features of a boy or the features of a girl, but I identify as the opposite gender. Prior to this week, 33 of the 50 United States had some kind of policy on athletic participation by those who are transgender students. The state of Minnesota adopted theirs this week, despite the reality of thousands, including mine. If you'd like to see the letter that I wrote to the Minnesota State High School League, I'll be happy to pass it along to you. Send me a text or an email, and I'll send it on to you. Despite the opposition, there was an agenda here. The Minnesota State High School League is comprised of athletic directors. Their educational background normally is in a field like phys ed, maybe coaching. So you have to ask the question, the language that is in the policy, where did it originate? I know athletic directors. They're good guys, hardworking guys and women. Most of them do not have either the educational background or the interest in doing the necessary research to put into policy the language that is in the policy. So where did it come from? If it's piqued your interest, go look it up. Not now, but later. It is easily identifiable what the source is. And I will tell you, it is not an athletic director. Nor is it a school administrator. It is an outside force. Worldview is so important. It is literally in our faces. And we as Christian people, you'll remember that Paul says in Colossians, we are to identify every false philosophy, but we are to address it. Peter says this. You might want to jot this text down because it's not on your handout. This is the text which identifies this next section. It is 1 Peter 3:15, which in part says this. Sanctify the Lord in your hearts. Set apart the Lord in your hearts. And be ready always to give an answer, a defense, the New King James says. A defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. And we are in that part of our study in the education hour, trying to supply answers, apologetics to questions that we have and questions that an unbelieving world has. Let's pray. I already prayed, didn't I? Did I pray? I think I prayed already. I'm sorry, I got ahead of myself. I think I already prayed. Here's what we're working on today. You'll remember this is our theme throughout the class. A Christian worldview enables us to look at all of life through scriptural lenses, which in turn equips us to defend the faith, evangelize wisely, critique unbiblical thought that pervades our culture, and bring God glory in all of life. We have a goal today. I want to see if we can try to answer this question. If seeing is believing, how can you believe in an invisible God? Interesting question. Have you ever seen him? No. Then how do you know he exists? The old song says, I know he lives because he lives within my heart. Remember that song? Is that the only answer? How do you know, how do you believe in an invisible God? The goal today is to demonstrate that believing in God is reasonable, consistent with reason, and is actually more rational than the alternative of believing in his non existence. I don't know if you have talked with somebody who doesn't believe in God. Maybe you have. Maybe they actually reject the whole idea that there is a God outside of our closed system, using their terminology. We, of course, embrace an open system, right? Or maybe you've met people who are more likely just practically rejecting the idea of a God. That is to say, to live here and now as if there is nothing else, and this is all that matters. To answer the question of the existence of God, I want to give to you six arguments for his existence this morning. We'll have to plow through these rather quickly to get all of them in today, but I think we can do it. And the goal is to demonstrate, as you see there on the screen. And I think that what these six arguments will do for you is they'll provide some tools, some basic answers that you can use when you are speaking to others on, is there a God? Six arguments for God are this: probability, creation and design, anthropic arguments, argument from immaterialism, a transcendental argument, and what is called an ontological argument. Let's consider them in order this morning. What about probability? Probability says this, that faith in the supernatural is plausible, more plausible than the alternative. Maybe we need to define a term. Who could help me with the word plausible? Possible. Anybody else? Likely. Okay, so those are some ideas. Faith in the supernatural is likely, more likely than the alternative. I think there is a misconception that people who are people of faith, like you and I are, that we believe in fairy tales or fables or myths. This morning I'll be preaching on the crossing of the Red Sea. Wikipedia is becoming, those of you who have advanced degrees, you might be surprised by this. Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia, is quickly becoming an accepted reference tool in academic papers. It's just how the world is changing. If you were to go to the crossing of the Red Sea on the Wikipedia page, right in the first sentences, the word myth appears. So if you believe, I believe completely. As much as I believe that I'm standing in front of you today, I believe that Moses led millions of Hebrew people through a gap God created in the Red Sea to escape Pharaoh and his army. Many think that is nothing more than an ancient myth. And as a Christian, the misconception about us is that this is what we believe. We do not believe that things based in fact or evidence or rational thinking, and therefore we cannot be taken seriously in any kind of conversations. This is the disposition, for example, of Bill Maher. This is the disposition of, for example, of the illusionist Penn, of the famous Penn and Teller. They do not say that people are stupid. They say you believe something that's stupid, something that is entirely mythological. And therefore, when you have conversations about it, you cannot be taken seriously because of what you embrace on the idea. Yes. Sure. Yeah, so sometimes even how we use the terminology can maybe even take away from what we think we're saying about something in God's Word. So what does it mean to have faith then? How do you decide what to believe in, and what not to believe? Well, here is the bottom line. In order to live in our world, we are all required to exercise faith. If you put gasoline in your car at a gas station this week, if you ate meat purchased from a grocery store or purchased from a farmer, you in some way exercise some measure of faith that what you were acquiring to put in your vehicle or to put in your body is okay. If you go and use the drinking fountain out here in the building, we don't have, as everyone here knows probably, we don't have water from the metropolitan water supply that you probably have at your home if you live not somewhere in the boondocks or in Sunfish Lake, but we have a well. Well, how do you know that our well is not contaminated? I mean, you just stuck your head in there and took a big old swallow. To live in our world, the point is we have to exercise faith every day. And we exercise faith every day using three tools of faith. The first one is reason. Or someone might call it science. Reason. The second is intuition. And the third, our experiences. Many people, when talking about matters of faith, decide that only observable, knowable, scientific information can be used. And what I would suggest to you is that position really creates an anti-supernatural bias. It concludes that there is nothing in the supernatural that engages in the world. And you begin with that particular premise. What it leads to is an agenda-centric approach to evidence, as opposed to an evidence-centric approach. Instead of looking at evidence and saying, where does it lead me? The agenda is here first. Now let me look at the evidence and see if the evidence supports my agenda. To argue for God is to argue that faith in the supernatural is plausible, more plausible than the alternative. Second one, creation and design. Creation by an intelligent designer is more intellectually plausible, likely, than by random chance. This asks some questions. How did everything start? What is the origin of the universe? When you think about it, there really are two basic answers to that question. The first answer is this. The universe is self-created. Or, second answer, the universe was created by something else. Those are really the two answers that can be provided to coming up with the origin of where we live. The question then about those two answers is this. Which view do you have faith in? Because it is not a matter of science versus faith. But it is, as we saw in that video a number of weeks ago, a matter of faith versus faith. Naturalism. Naturalism is another name for what we would commonly know as evolution. Naturalism assumes that the origins of everything began through time and chance and employ a simple equation. Here's the equation. Impersonal force. Call it whatever you want. Energy, matter, space, atoms. Call it whatever you want. An impersonal force. You add to that time. And you add to that chance. The result? Creation. I mentioned to you that when I was in Midland, Michigan, I attended at Central Michigan University. Thus, everybody is happier. It's less burden on the healthcare system. It's less burden on the economic system. It's less burden on the caregivers. And who would want to live that way anyway? It's less burden on the individual whose life we are ending. As a side note, this is why, for those of you who are in college now, or those of you who are anticipating going to college, it is so critical that you are careful where you choose to educate your mind and the class offerings that you take. Our daughter Emily is taking a class at Embry Hills Community College, History of Civilization. Should seem simple enough, right? History of Civilization. Within the first 2 days of her class, Brett and I became aware this was not a history class. This was a philosophy class taught at our local community college, where all the local kids don't even use its full name because it's so familiar to us. Where are you going to school? I'm going to Inver. Everybody knows what that means. It is critical that you be very, very careful when you put yourself in that kind of tutelage. Now, I would suggest to you that Singer's conclusion that happiness, maximizing happiness in the best interest of society, is how you form a moral ethic, I don't really think that he is intellectually or emotionally honest about that. I reject it because logically the assumptions don't work in the real world. His own mother, a number of years ago, he provided her in the latter part of her life with the medical care and dignity that she needed. Apparently, he was unable to live emotionally without the implications of his belief. This week, I saw a video clip of the President of the United States delivering a State of the Union address, and I don't remember which year it was. But in the balcony, you know how the President always has guests in the balcony during the State of the Union. He had a United States Marine Corps soldier sitting next to his wife in the balcony, and he had been severely wounded in combat. Not only was his body mangled, but his mind had been impacted as well by the concussion of the IED. Well, let's take this to its logical conclusion. We've all seen images of wounded warriors, some of whom return home and they now walk on their hands if they still have those. Their legs are gone. Well, wouldn't it be better for the whole of society if when any of those men returned home in that condition, that instead of providing them care and treating them with honor and dignity for sacrificing the way that we did, we simply said it would be less burden upon the whole of society economically, emotionally, intellectually. It'd be easier for him if he wasn't just here. Let's just end his life. But we all say that there's something that is not right about that. So where does this come from? Where do our ideas of right and wrong initiate? I would suggest to you this, that a morality that is relative doesn't satisfy our desire for justice and fairness, and therefore should be rejected. Think about it. We live as though some things are right and other things are wrong. It's why when you drive into one of the huge busy parking lots during the Christmas season and it seems like every space is full and you find one. And so you see an individual backing out and you're on this side, you're facing that direction and the person is backing out and here comes somebody down the lane. You know, you feel it. He better not take my spot. Because you are not a believer in that moment of relativistic morality, are you? And when the person backs out, and now you're behind, and this person is free just to turn right in, and you were there first. And you feel that sense of justice rising up into you. That's wrong. Where does that come from? You don't live. Human beings don't live like relativistic morality is acceptable. You know, I don't think that any of our Sunday school teachers, I would be surprised if any parent, before sending his son or daughter to preschool, says, now listen, there's a very, very important rule that everybody in preschool should know. That important rule is no cuts. So here are our children standing outside when teachers bring them, and they're right by the water fountain. And they're this big. And they intuitively know that cutting in line is wrong. No cuts! How do they know that? No parent goes through every day, here are 25 rules for living today with a child, and then says the next day, now we did 25 yesterday, big day today, we got to go 50 today. Here's what it takes to live in a moral society. We all know that. We all get it. We all live as though some things are objectively right and other things are objectively wrong. It doesn't need adequate explanation. So what do we have? We have within us a desire for justice. And we generally know the difference between what's right and what's wrong. And we need to ask ourselves, where did this come from? The anthropic argument says that comes from God. It has been planted in our brain. It's called our conscience. The text that you might want to write down is Romans chapter 2, verses 14 to 15, which teaches us that in the same way that there are laws in nature, we believe that there are also moral laws, absolutes, that flow from God, that He has built into us as a standard of right and wrong. Revelation 2, 14 and 15. Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature things required by the law. That's what we're talking about, Romans 2 says. They are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law. Since they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts now accusing, now even defending them. God has provided us a very wonderful gift. It is called our consciences, something He has given to us, which reveals in us His nature. There is another part of the anthropic arguments that comes into play here as well, and that is called religious experience and the yearning for eternity. All of us have, every person has a desire within them that has yet to be satisfied. We want, actually, eternity. And that desire points to a need for a relationship with God. Why are humans, why are you, why am I so difficult to satisfy? It really is a universal experience. The atheist Jean-Paul Sartre wrote this, quote, "There comes a time when one asks, even of Shakespeare, even of Beethoven, is that all there is?" Let me go to the opposite extreme. Some of you may remember the Rolling Stones song, this line of which, "I can't get no," next word, "satisfaction." It's a universal idea. We are unsatisfied beings. Much more profound than either of the two of those, you men who were at our men's weekend, you'll remember that we studied together Ecclesiastes and Solomon's evaluation of human experience. Do you remember what he said? He said, there's nothing new under the sun. There are no new novel ideas. Solomon writes in Ecclesiastes that satisfaction from work and profit is only temporary. Why? Because one day we'll leave our work to someone else, and someone else will be controlling what we built. In Ecclesiastes, Solomon talked about material possessions and pleasures. He said that those are unfulfilling. Solomon said that he refused not a single pleasure to himself. He tried every single one. And the result, his evaluation, not satisfied. Solomon writes in Ecclesiastes that death comes on every person. It doesn't matter how good you were in your life. It doesn't matter how bad you were in your life. It doesn't matter how smart you were in your life. It doesn't matter how foolish you were in your life. Death comes to everybody. So what's the point? Solomon concluded that the world is vain, meaningless. It's like chasing after the wind. So how do you help somebody here? All right, see the place where it says pop quiz? Let's do a pop quiz. So get your pen out, your pencil, and let's take a pop quiz together. I want you to answer this question. Would you do this? Here's the question. What would really satisfy me? That is you. So maybe write down the question. What would really satisfy me? Now, my guess is, go ahead and give the answer. You're probably going to get all spiritual on me since you happen to be in a church building, and you'll probably provide some of those answers. But what would really satisfy? I'm going to give you 30 more seconds to answer that question. All right, good. You probably have had enough time to answer that question. Now here's the next question. What then? How might somebody who is not a believer, you're a believer, how might somebody answer that question who is not a believer? How might somebody answer the question, what would really satisfy you, who's not a believer? Pardon me? And not just money, but tons of money. Lots of money. That would really satisfy. How might somebody else answer? Perfect health. Anybody else? Power. So, in talking with somebody about arguments for God, one of the arguments that you can use is this. What would really satisfy you? And then the next question is, what's next? What then? All right, so let's take Mitchell's. Mitchell, you be the person who answers that question, okay? What would really satisfy you?
Money.
Money. What then? Keeping your money. What then?
I don't know.
Getting more money. What then? Protecting that money. What then? Until you feel like you've gotten enough? Then what? We ultimately, all of us are going to end up at the same place no matter what the question is, which is where. You're going to end up at death. And then you have another question. What then? I don't know. Well, where did that longing come from? Where did that desire come from? And the anthropic argument says that longing exists in you because God put it there for you. We have this desire, so why can't we fulfill it? We have this desire for something more. Why can't we fulfill it? Think about it. It seems like every other innate desire that we have, there is a real object that satisfies that desire. Think about this. So when you're thirsty, what do you do? What do? You get a drink. And you're what? You're satisfied. And when you're hungry, what do? You get something to eat. Now, what do some of you moms do when your kids come to you and say, "I'm hungry"? What do you do? Holly, what did you do when your little ones would come to you and say, "Mom," when your boys, all of them who are always hungry, what would you do when your boys would come and say, "Mom, I'm hungry"? Okay, so let's say it's 30 minutes after lunch. What might you do? Besides say no. I'm sure you weren't just saying no. Well, what did you say? What would any of you moms say? Did any of you moms have an answer? What'd you say, Lynn? You just ate. You can't be hungry, you just ate. Go outside and play. Right? Now, when a child goes outside and plays, is that child no longer hungry? Excellent. He's just distracted. Or maybe he's forgotten, but he still is hungry. What is the only thing that is going to deal with the hunger? What's the only thing that's going to do that? Food. And just like drink will satisfy thirst and food will satisfy hunger. And this takes us right to the story of Jesus in John chapter 4. What happens in John chapter 4? Who knows what's there in John 4? The woman at the well. And you'll remember, she has all these husbands, right? And what does Jesus say her problem is? She's thirsty. That's her problem. He doesn't say that her problem is she's immoral. Is she immoral? Absolutely. But that's not her issue. Her issue is she has this desire which she is attempting to satisfy. And her mechanism for satisfying this desire is what? What is her mechanism? She's trying to find a man. But every man that she tries leaves her. Still leaves her thirsty. Still leaves her unsatisfied. So Jesus says to her, in John 4, if you were to ask of me for, what kind? Living water, I would give it to you, and what would happen to you? You would what? You would never thirst again. So, where did this desire come from? Where did this innate desire that we long to have satisfied originate? Anthropic argument answers that question by saying that it exists because God put it there, and He is the only one that can satisfy that. One more under this anthropic: the capacity for good and evil. Human nature really is most consistently explained by the Christian view of man created in God's image, but born as sinners. Why do people live the way they do? You know, really, we are given to actions that we can characterize as very good or very evil. This summer, I read and finished just a number of weeks ago the entire Harry Potter series. Never read it before, and I read it for reason. We have no problem understanding how a mother can sacrifice her life to save her baby. It's the beginning premise that the Harry Potter series is built on. His mother saves him from the killing curse of an evil wizard. And we read that, and anyone who reads that no one is surprised by that. No one is surprised when a mother sacrifices her own life for her child, right? Nobody's surprised by that. By the same token, while it might be incredibly offensive to us when we hear on the news that a mother drove her car into a river with her two children inside in their car seats, we're horrified at that. And we'll say things like, how could a mother do that? But we do believe she did it. Okay. Yep. Those things happen. So how do you explain that? I mean, have you ever wondered how an unsaved person can do morally good things? Have you ever asked that question? How is that even possible? And the answer is Christianity and its beliefs supply that answer. It supplies it this way. One, we are made in the image of God. And two, we have rebelled against Him. There is no other philosophy which reconciles man's capacity for good and his tendency towards great evil like Christianity does. How is it possible for an unsaved person to do morally good things? Answer, because that unsaved person is created in the image of God. That's how it's possible even for an unsaved man or an unsaved woman to do something that reflects God's character or God's moral goodness. There is within him some capacity to do good because he's made in the image of God. But though we are made in the image of God, all of us have rebelled against him, what we call sin. We're saddened by evil, we're saddened by sin, but we're not surprised by it. You and I understand that apart from Christ, all of us are by nature rebels against God. What that simply means is this. We would rather do things our own way than do things God's way. And here is a really important point then. When our way and God's way mesh, we're okay with that. But when our way and God's way conflict, we are going to take our own way. But God knows and sees everything that we do. He sees our thoughts. He sees our motivations. He sees our dreams. And His character requires a penalty if we violate His moral law. What's happened in the culture over these last few weeks and months concerning Michael Brown and Eric Grange, everybody knows about those two cases, right? These are the police killings. Everybody knows about that. Take the most recent one. Seen the video, right? This is not, bringing this illustration up is not to tell you what you should or shouldn't believe about that. That's not my point. My point is that under our system, there was process. You had a grand jury hearing. A prosecutor presented evidence. And the grand jury concluded no indictment. And now there is a significant portion of our population that is in an uproar about that. Right? Because it believes that a moral injustice has been done. And it cannot accept that that moral injustice is good or satisfying. In that same way, We would take no satisfaction in a God who would allow open rebellion to go unpunished. We would say that that God is unjust. But this is the big idea of Christianity. Christianity believes, and Christians believe, that God both punishes sin and forgives sin. And that, of course, is the whole of the gospel. There are anthropic arguments that deal with the existence of God. Let me give you the last ones here very quickly. Argument from immaterialism. What does this mean? Real quick here, humans routinely experience and accept matters of the universe that they cannot see. For example, how many of you accept the idea of love, L-O-V-E? You accept the idea of love, that it exists. All right, about half of you. Anybody ever seen love? No. Nobody's ever seen love. What is it that when you see a feature of nature, what is it that just takes your breath away when you see that? Whether it's a mountain scene or the ocean or the Grand Canyon or a waterfall or a beautiful rainbow, what is it inside of you that makes you go, this is an argument from immaterialism. These last ones, I'm giving them to you quickly. You can Google them and study more on them if it's of importance to you. Transcendental simply means this. The precondition for all knowledge, logic, science, and concepts is God. The laws of physics, the laws of mathematics, all originate in this argument with God. You'll remember that when we were studying modern and postmodern a few weeks ago, that there is among them the idea that, well, we can't really know anything at all. And yet, we believe, this argument teaches, that God is the precondition for knowledge. He made the world, He knows all the facts that are in the world, He made us in His image with capacity and capability to know things, He upholds both us and His world consistently. The laws of economics begin with God. The laws of physics begin with God. The laws of relationships begin with God. This is where it all starts. Last one. Ontological. This is probably the most difficult of ones to explain. I'm going to spend very little time here. You can study this, look it up on your own if you'd like. I would suggest to you that this one bolsters a believer's idea about God more so than it will persuade an unbeliever to think that there is a God. Simply, the idea says this: the greatest concept is God, and He possesses the attributes of His existence. Therefore, He exists. The ontological argument says, because we can think of a concept of God, and because the concept about which we think, this God has that one that we identify with these attributes, that is God. As I said, it's not likely to persuade an unbeliever, but it can bolster believers. On the back side, you have one more comment. A number of years ago, this thought came to mind. Unbelief never has enough proof. The greatest example of that is Jesus Christ. If those who experienced the living, walking, breathing, resurrected Jesus would not accept Him, despite what the apostle called infallible proofs, when he wrote to the Corinthians, despite his display of infallible proofs, they rejected Him. Unbelief never has enough proof. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be ready to give an answer for the hope that lies in us. It means this, that if your heart rejects Bible truths, I can present to you argument after argument after argument after argument. And if you choose not to believe, there probably is not a lot I can do for you. Unbelief never has enough proof. We got to get going here quick, but I think I saw a hand. Anyone? We have to get going. So, you sent me a number of questions last week. I tried to answer one or two of them this morning. I will tell you that some of the questions that you sent to me are outside of what I'm going to be able to cover here, but I'll try to answer them to you in an email back to you. If there's more that you want to know, let's make sure that we talk about that together. Thanks, everyone. Appreciate it.